Welcome to the Do Your Good podcast series. In this podcast series, you'll hear from me, Sybil, and other experts in the field to help you make your money matter and make a huge difference in the world. I come to you with over two decades of experience as a person who's helped donors give away over $45 million in donations, both large and small. This podcast series is meant to give you the tools you need to be effective in the world and fund nonprofits and issues that you care about with meaning and purpose, and to make a true, deep difference in the world.
Hello, everyone. I am deeply moved by the issue of firearm-related suicide prevention. I'm deeply moved by this topic because I just spent many months interviewing experts and thinking carefully about how to reduce the rate of suicide by firearm in Oregon. Please note that the discussion about suicide prevention is a very sensitive topic. Only listen to this podcast season if you're adequately prepared for the discussion. If you or someone you love is struggling with thoughts of suicide, please seek professional support and call the 988 Lifeline for immediate care and help. One of my philanthropic clients, the Roundhouse Foundation, identifies this issue as a critical one. Let me give you some of the data that inspired them to work on this issue. The most recent Center for Disease Control data available show that 655 people died by a firearm in Oregon in 2022. The CDC data also show that the suicide rate overall in Oregon was 883 people, which is 19.3 per every 100,000 people in Oregon. The suicide rate by firearm in rural and remote communities is particularly concerning and dangerously high. The Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health reviewed firearm deaths in Oregon and discovered that three counties with the highest gun death rates from 2011 to 2020 were Harney County, Klamath County, and Josephine County. These are all rural and remote counties. All three counties had a firearm death rate two times the state average. And this same review from Johns Hopkins showed that males were seven times as likely to die by firearm than females, and 55% were suicides by firearm. In addition, white males over the age of 34 accounted for 23% of the population in Oregon in 2020, but 61% of all suicide decedents. The people who live in rural and remote communities share a commonality in that they live many, many miles often from support services and law enforcement, and this means that those who own firearms often depend on their weapons for food and security. Let me explain this better. In Harney County is a rural county in Oregon, so if you're not from Oregon, though, let me explain like how rural we're talking about. Harney County alone is 10,228 square miles. This is larger than 10 of the other states in the United States, and it's twice the size of Connecticut. And since the rate of firearm injury and suicide is significantly higher in counties outside of the major metropolitan regions, the focus of my inquiry for this client I have, the Roundhouse Foundation, and also as a result, this podcast season, it's on the steps to take specifically to support the unique characteristics that define this specific population of individuals in rural and remote communities. I talked with some experts about this data, and here's what they had to say. Here's some thoughts from Aaron Borla of the Roundhouse Foundation.
You know, especially when we look at the data, our organization focuses primarily on rural and indigenous communities. And when you look at the data of firearm deaths, yes, mass shootings and community violence are a huge issue. But the reality is there are more gun deaths to firearms that are suicide. And we're not talking about that.
And here's some thoughts from Donna Marie Drucker from the Oregon Firearm Safety Coalition.
70% of people never have a second suicide attempt if they survive their first attempt. So the means that people come in contact with when they're struggling really, really matters. And while any means can be lethal, firearms, handguns particularly, are incredibly lethal, 90% lethal. So people never get that second chance. Literally, the only reason why I'm alive is because I couldn't get a hold of that handgun. So I want to work with gun owners. I'm still a gun owner myself. I still have firearms in the house. I am a member of more than one gun club. I am a member of our Girl in a Gun club in Sherwood. I enjoy shooting. I loved my target practice. I'm getting ready to start to compete so that I can be a competitive shooter. Like, shooting firearms are an integral part of my life, and I love it. However, creating time and distance between somebody who's having a hard time and a firearm is the best way to prevent the loss of a life. That's why I do this work, because I want to make sure everybody gets that second chance.
For the report I worked on for the Roundhouse Foundation on this issue, I interviewed over 30 people, and I reviewed and researched over 100 documents. The journey was amazing, and in the beginning of the journey, the answer felt fairly simple. I'm somebody who was looking at the firearm issue and the gun control issue a little bit from the outside before I started this in-depth research. And the simple solution is, if someone is having suicidal ideation, the data show and the statistics and the information research show that a person who is suffering from suicidal ideation, when they decide to act, they oftentimes act very quickly. And if there's a way to intervene before they act, and a loved one can tell the person that they're very important, that we love them, and that there's no judgment involved, then that person can decide to change course. And when the means of suicide is not easily available for the person, then that allows them more time to think and to talk and seek help. And so the idea is that if you remove firearms from the immediate vicinity of the person who is at risk of suicide, the theory is that you could then reduce that risk. And like I said before, there are studies that back up this theory. So when my client asked me to work on this, we started talking about something called extreme risk protection orders, otherwise called ERPOs. So you'll hear people throughout this podcast season saying ERPO, and that's what that means, extreme risk protection orders. And those orders are effectively a court order. They're a civil order that will allow a loved one or law enforcement to remove a firearm from somebody if they are at risk of suicide. So the idea was, the Secretary of State in Oregon recently reviewed the number of extreme risk protection orders, or ERPOs, that were issued in Oregon, and it found that the uptake in that for that those orders was just not that high. And the question presented to me is, why? Is there a way that we can increase the number of ERPOs available to people and to loved ones who care and are worried about someone who's at risk of suicide, to maybe invoke that to hopefully, the theory goes, then reduce the number of suicides? So what I quickly found, y'all, is that that solution was overly simplistic. When we're talking about people who live in rural and remote communities who appear from the data to be the most at risk, these are people who identify with their firearms in a way that's very complicated. And by simply removing the firearm as sort of a first step, that's just showing too much judgment right away. Because people use their firearms for a whole host of issues. Self-defense, they use their firearms for food and security. It's much more complicated than that. And so this entire podcast season, I bring you on my journey. Such an important topic. I also feel I'm very glad that I'm able to share this with you, because this is actually the kind of journey that I go down with my clients on a whole host of really, really tough issues. And oftentimes I can't share this kind of journey on my podcast because the topics are so hard, they're so sensitive, and most of my interviewees and also work with my clients is highly confidential. In this case, I got permission to talk about my journey. All the opinions expressed in this podcast are mine alone and not that of the Roundhouse Foundation, but I am creating a report, a public report for them around ERPOs and possible next steps for how to navigate the question of How do we increase the uptake of ERPOs? But more importantly, how do we address firearm-related suicide in Oregon, which is such a challenge? I'm offering you now some quotes from the people I talked to about extremist protection orders, because I want you to start thinking about how this particular law might fit into the overarching true concern that we all have in Oregon to decrease the number of firearm-related suicides in rural Oregon. Ashley Davenport from Deschutes County, she was the Deschutes County Victims Assistant Director. She recently got a new job, but was the Victims Assistant Director for 9 years and has a lot of wonderful insights.
Well, so in my role for the last 9.5 years, it's my job to have knowledge around protective orders that are available both to civilians and to law enforcement. And part of that is to be knowledgeable about extreme risk protective orders. And what's helpful about those is that it's a tool for individuals who have risen to a level of unsafe behavior for themselves or others, specifically with firearm usage. What's great about ERPOs is that we give people options. So if they're a family that don't feel like law enforcement involvement is good for that individual or their circumstance, then there is an option for family to apply for an extreme risk protective order on behalf of the person they're concerned about. However, if that would be too difficult, and I think, you know, anyone thinking about the daunting task of filing a protective order against a loved one, if that's too much for you, there's also the option of looping in law enforcement, explaining your risks, your concerns and your risks to law enforcement, and having them engage in that ERPO process, kind of taking that burden off of the family and instead utilizing a government official to help keep your individual safe. But an ERPO is a really good way of putting additional steps in the way or things that they have to go through. It makes it harder for someone to get a means of lethality that is easily purchasable in our current day and age.
And Ashley goes into some of the challenges of the logistics of issuing an ERPO I found interesting. Have a listen.
For a loved one or a family member to not only have to put pen to paper, to write down some of the things that have happened in the sanctuary of their home, but to then stand up before a judge and have to say that in front of their loved one, that is just such a burden to carry. Again, that person actually can say, I contest this ERPO. And then it becomes kind of a mini trial per se. Each side needs to be able to put on evidence. And when you think about the lay person that is out there, who probably just has enough information from Law and Order or Criminal Minds to be dangerous, that is just a lot for that person to have to do to move forward with that ERPO.
In this next excerpt from Ashley, you're going to hear her respond to my question of, why do you think ERPOs aren't being used as much as they could?
I think false information. I think being scared of red flag laws, it really is not meant to violate anybody's constitutional rights. It really is meant to support them in getting healthy to maintain their constitutional rights. And so if you view it that way, which is how I believe it was intended, it is just such a healthier viewpoint. And sometimes we get stuck on feeling like we are violating somebody's right. And I really want to stress here that that's not what I feel the intent is. I truly feel the intent is that we're helping someone temporarily to maintain their right in the long term. We just want them to do it in a healthy and happy manner as part of our community.
And this is what Donna Marie Drucker from the Oregon Firearm Safety Coalition has to say about extreme risk protection orders.
So a lot of people know my position around extreme risk protection orders and suicide prevention. I'm not sure that they are the right vehicle. We are very careful with language around suicide. We don't use the term commit suicide anymore because it has such negative connotations from when it was a crime. We try to reduce stigma around suicide. You know, there's a lot of stigma about mental health, you know, that people with mental health disorders are dangerous. Like, we've worked so hard to reduce that stigma, reduce those barriers. And then we say, oh, we need to put an extreme risk protection order on somebody. We're telling them that they're an extreme risk. And extreme risk protection orders were designed, sadly, after heinous events to prevent criminals from committing additional heinous events. So while extreme risk protection orders definitely serve a purpose, and I'm not going to deny that they don't, you know, there are folks that when they reach the criteria, fine, that's whatever. But people that are at risk for suicide, it takes a long time for them to reach that criteria. And in my opinion, by the time somebody has reached that sort of criteria, we've kind of failed them in the world of mental health and behavioral health, that there's actions that can be taken ahead of time, like voluntarily, can we voluntarily store your firearms out of the home? Can we make sure that there's all these secure storage devices in your home? Can we connect you with behavioral health and additional supports? Extreme risk protection orders in Oregon have a very high criteria. They're not easy to obtain. So we really want to be reaching folks that are having a hard time long before they meet that criteria.
What Donna Marie Drucker is talking about here when she refers to extreme risk protection orders coming out of really heinous events, the ERPO law was thought of and created in response to the Sandy Hook shooting, mass shooting in Connecticut, the horrible mass shooting in 2012. And since then, over 21 states have adopted extreme risk protection orders to remove the main goal that came from that 2012 response is to remove firearms proactively from people who may commit mass shootings. But it has also been used as a tool. And what the data show nationally is that extreme risk protection orders have also been used to remove firearms from a person who is at risk of suicide, and they may not be at risk of doing a mass shooting at all. And so that is what Donna Marie is talking about and is one of the key issues that people are discussing around the use of ERPOs to reduce firearm-related suicide. So I wanted to interject that. And this is what Michael Sedini from Walk the Talk America has to say.
When it comes to ERPOs, there's a lot of nuance in this discussion, and a lot of people can't have this discussion with nuance because ERPOs bring out emotion, whether it's, you know, whether you're pro red flag or, you know, anti-red flag. I come from a different world, and it's one that many people from the anti-gun side or the people that say, hey, like, this is common sense, can't understand, because when they think of ERPOs, they think of the worst case scenario, which is perfect for an ERPO, right? Like, if I'm seeing things and I have a gun in my hand and you are worried about me because I might be a harm to myself, or you're worried about a kid kicking a ball in the yard and I think it's an alien that's come down to take my life and I shoot, right? Like, those are the perfect scenarios where you say, like, there needs to be some form of law that removes the firearms from Mike while he's in crisis. But in my world, ERPOs do more harm than good. And a lot of people have trouble when I say that statement, but it simply comes from the fact of, if I had a dollar for every time somebody has contacted me and said they will not get help because of the red flag law in their state, I wouldn't have to go champion for money. And to me, that's a barrier to entry to get help. How many people out there have not or will not go get help because they're afraid to lose their firearm rights? And most people don't think about that. I remember being on a panel at the Aspen Institute of Health last year, and the two people that went before me were very pro red flag law. And I said exactly what I just said to you. And it was crazy because I spent the next 2 days walking around the campus where the festival is at, and people were stopping me and saying, I've never thought about it that way. Like, you've given me something to think about. I still hate guns, but I've never thought about it that way. I always thought you people wanted to just arm everybody. I never thought that it could be a barrier to entry or could prevent someone from getting help. Why do I have to lose my firearms for an entire year? I might be fine in a week. I might be fine in a month. I might be fine in 6 months. I really don't like the idea that the government or your local police force can come in while you're in crisis or someone accuses you of being in crisis and they say, let me take your firearms from you, sir. Okay, you can get these back in a year if you act right. But they don't take anything else out of the house that I could be destructive with. They don't take the knives. They don't drain the pool. They don't take my car. They don't take my medication or anything that I have in there that I could potentially, they don't take the rope, right? They only take the firearms. And then once they leave with that, you're on your own.
I want to interject here because you might have heard Michael talking about the 1 year mark. An extremist protection order can last for up to a year. So that's what that's about. And I also noticed that a lot of folks are interchanging the word ERPO with red flag law, that when you hear the word red flag law, that's the same thing as an ERPO, just so you know. So red flag equals extremist protection order. And last but not least, I really like what Jess Marks has to say from the Oregon Alliance for Gun Safety.
Yeah, thanks. It's a great question. And I think in so many situations involving firearms, there is the reality that at all times we're balancing community safety and rights. And to me, I do think it's really important that that process is built into ERPOs in order to have kind of longer term trust that, you know, the government can't just take away your firearms. We do need to have that due process built in. And from a mental health lens, it is really frustrating because, you know, if you're in a mental health situation, what we would most want is, you know, we have counselors or peer support or veteran peer support. We want our doctors, you know, we want people who we trust who are engaged in this process. So I personally would like to see that there is much more training and potentially longer term that healthcare actually practitioners can themselves either petition to ERPOs or work and support family members to petition and at least have much more awareness of them. And that if we begin to look at ERPOs, and we could actually go back a second and talk about that, you know, ERPOs were originally developed as a tool to prevent mass shootings and school shootings. And what happened was over time, people began to actually realize that they were pretty effective at preventing suicide. You know, for every 10 ERPOs issued, the data started to show a life was saved. That really matters. I mean, these are our community members. Like, this is a kid that went to my high school. This is our teacher. This is my grandpa. You know, it's like, these are people in our communities. We're not just talking data, we're talking individuals. And so I think because of that, we need to really go back and think through how do we put the kind of wraparound tools on an ERPO that would give more support to families so that if somebody is served an ERPO or if they decide to petition for an ERPO for their family or a loved one or a colleague, that they have the support around them they need.
And I love Jess's optimism in this last excerpt that I offer for you from her.
You know, I actually feel very optimistic that we're moving towards a direction where ERPOs and secure storage become an example of how we can meaningfully address firearm suicide while respecting firearm owners, and that, in fact, it could become a leadership example, and I would love to see Oregon be in the lead in doing this.
To give you a sense of the scale of this challenge and why it's so important we discuss it, according to the National Shooting Sports Federation, which is the Firearm Industry Trade Association, Over 15.9 million firearms were sold in the United States in 2023 alone. The NSSF estimates that the industry has a $90 billion impact, and major industry retailers make a profit of $150 million or more per year. So it's important to consider the firearm industry and how many firearms are sold each year and what this means in terms of the scale of the challenge in supporting people to really find solutions to this complex issue. So I hope this now has gotten you super intrigued. What are the solutions? The next two episodes of this season are going to get into those solutions. So stay tuned for those and listen carefully. I look forward to the continued conversation. And I want to thank all the people who I interviewed for this podcast season because they really showed a lot of vulnerabilities. This is a very intense topic, and it's gotten political in the past, as you all know, and it still is. And so I just really appreciate that all of the people I talked to allowed themselves to be vulnerable in the conversation. And by the end of this series, I think you're going to see that there's a lot more that everyone has in common than you would have thought otherwise. So stay tuned for the future episodes. So there you have it. I hope you enjoyed this podcast as much as I enjoyed making it for you. So if you want to find out more about what I have to offer, please check out www.doyourgood.com and learn more ways to make your money matter. Until next time, do your good and be well.